白宫宣布哈里斯东南亚行程，南中国海安全成焦点。习近平致下60多万中国人出国寻求庇护。美中关系专家夏伟谈新书《故乡》，讲述毛时代到64之间的风风雨雨。各位观众好，欢迎收看《美国观察》，我是文浩。在今天的节目里，我们将连线驻纽约记者方冰，了解一下中国领导人习近平上台以来向外国申请政治庇护的中国人数猛增的现象。另外，美国之音记者许湘云采访了美中关系专家夏伟，谈谈他的新书《故乡》。这本书讲述了从毛泽东时代到64天安门学生抗议这几十年当中，一对父子所经历的风风雨雨。美国观察的节目热线已经开通，欢迎您拨打0021-202-920-4990，与我们分享您对节目的看法，告诉我们您希望看到的节目内容。我们的号码是0021-202-920-4990。首先看到新闻，美国白宫星期二宣布了副总统哈里斯首次访问东南亚国家的初步行程，称印太地区，特别是南中国海的安全，将是他这次访问的一个焦点话题。白宫说，哈里斯将在8月20日至26日期间访问新加坡和越南，因为他们是美国在新时代重要的伙伴。哈里斯会聚焦美国政府对自由与开放印太地区的愿景，美国对维护包括南中国海在内的地区安全和国际秩序的承诺，以及美国与该地区国家发展经贸关系对美国人民的重要意义。哈里斯还强调，美国与东南亚地区国家崇尚共同的价值。美国国务院资深官员表示，美国了解东南亚国家，希望继续与经济大国中国发展和维护关系，称美国从来不要求任何国家在美国和中国之间做出选择，但美国希望向东南亚地区国家提供选项，向他们展示美国是一个真诚值得信赖的伙伴。另外，中国的科技巨头华为公司的首席财务官孟晚舟的引渡案8月4日在加拿大的比什省最高法院再次开审，预计这次庭审将会持续3个星期。四轮审理结束后，案件在这一级法院的审理工作也将结束，法官预计会在今年的秋季公布判决书。法官的最终裁决将决定孟晚舟的命运，或是无罪释放，或是把孟晚舟引渡到美国。如果同意引渡，法官将要把引渡要求送交加拿大的司法部执行。不过为了公平起见，加拿大的法律给予被告一方一次上诉机会，这个上诉程序可能会持续数年。孟晚舟的律师团队在此次庭审的目标是进一步向法官说明美国提出的引渡请求存在严重的瑕疵，孟晚舟在机场被捕过程中的合法权利受到侵害，以及他应该获释的理由。根据联合国难民事务高级专员署的数据，中国寻求庇护的人数在过去的10年里增长了13倍。在这10年当中，大部分的增长趋势是在中国国家主席习近平上台之后形成的。这些庇护寻求者是谁？他们寻求庇护的原因又是什么？与习近平实施的政策有什么样的关系？我们连线美国之音驻纽约记者方冰，请他来介绍一下详细情况。方冰你好。
文浩你好。
你好，那这个我们首先就介绍一下，这次这个联合国的数据，它是说了些什么？
好的，这个数据呢是来自联合国难民事务高级专员署的办公室。那么最先爆出这个数据的呢是《经济学人》杂志，然后呢我到了联合国的这个难民署网站，找到了这些数据。这些数据显示，从2010年到2020年。中国到别的国家寻求庇护的人数呢，从2010年的7732人激增到了2020年的107864人，那么10年是增加了13倍，这10年的人数加在一起呢，达到60多万人。那么我们知道，习近平是在2012年的年底这个上台的，那么2012年那一年的数字呢是15000多人。 那么然后呢，2013年变成了24000多人，2014年变成了47000多人，2015年到了57000多人，2016年到了7万多，啊，2017年呢到了将近9万，2018年呢是9万4，2019年呢就是104000多人，2020年呢就是将近10万8千人。那么我想在说这个数据的时候呢，我们要想要从这个数据当中读出什么东西来，那么首先要搞清楚什么是难民，什么是寻求庇护者。这个数字呢是讲的寻求庇护者的数字。那么在联合国的难民署的这个网站上，对于难民和寻求庇护者的这个定义是非常清楚的。根据国际法，难民是为了逃避迫害或生命、人身安全或自由遭到严重威胁而被迫逃离祖国的人。难民呢是受到国际法保护的，如果他们的生命或自由受到威胁的话，就不能够被遣返回国。今年7月28号，恰好就是联合国难民公署签约难民公约签署70周年，这项公约呢建立起了人民有获得庇护的权利。那么难民与这个寻求庇护者的区别是，联合国说一个寻求庇护的人，他是一个还没有被确认为难民的人，是一个认为自己是难民但还没有获得评估和批准的人，因此在这个阶段他还没有能够获得这个难民应有的权利，并不是每一个这个寻求庇护的人最后都能够获得成功的。文浩，
是，那根据你刚刚这个描述以及我们看到的这个图表，联合国的数据似乎没有很详细的显示出这个寻求庇护者他们的一些详细信息，比如说他们的种族、他们的身份、他们这个具体寻求政治庇护的或者说寻求庇护的这个具体分类。那么我不知道在你的采访过程当中呢，媒体和这个相关的专家有没有是他们是如何评估这些数据的？
是的，文浩，首先呢，报道这个经济学人报道这个数据的经济学人呢，他的这个报道讲得很明确，他的题目就是习近平统治下中国寻求庇护人士激增。这篇报道认为呢，这一数据的增长与习近平统治的政策有关。这篇报道说呢，习近平以一年比一年更紧的铁腕统治中国。文章举出了新疆建造这个在教育营，至少有100多万的人被关押在集中营里面。在国内，这个对这个维权律师的打压，比如2015年的709大抓捕，以及近年来国内外非政府组织、女权组织、教会的成员被逮捕，还有呢就是对香港的镇压，以及通过国安法来收紧控制等等。那么，总部在纽约市的这个一个人权组织叫做人权第一，是一个专门为没有办法聘请到称职的私人律师的寻求庇护者提供法律帮助的这么一个服务机构。同时呢，他也是倡导寻求庇护者在美国呢有这个庇护权利的这么一个呼吁的组织。那我采访了这个组织的难民计划法律策略主任安文修斯，他认为这些数据跟他这些年在工作当中所接触到的印象是一致的。我们来听安文怎么说。
That those numbers convey certainly is consistent with my experience over that same time period, and that there has been, I mean, we have seen a lot of requests for legal assistance in order to file for asylum from asylum seekers coming from China, and that has.And I would say across all of the categories that the Economist article mentions, right? So this ranges from activists of many different kinds, whether they're, you know, grassroots advocates from activists in local communities, people working, you know, Chinese human rights lawyers, people working on labor rights. I mean, the list goes on. And on the one hand, and then also a number of people whose claims have related in various ways to their status as members of ethnic minorities, or in some cases as activists within ethnic minority communities, but often simply ordinary citizens, you know, from groups that have been targeted. So yes, I mean, I don't find the data surprising.
曾经在这个胡锦涛时代被关押的这个维权律师滕彪也告诉我说呢，习近平上台以后，情况确实发生了很快的变化。他对民间的各种力量，不仅仅是律师，也包括记者、学者，包括宗教人士等等，当然对藏人、维吾尔人也都进行了大规模的这个镇压。那么因此呢，他认为这个就使得寻求政治庇护的人开始明显的上升，明显的增加。文浩，
那除了刚刚提到这么一些原因，我知道你还采访了不少人，那在你的这个采访过程当中，你还有没有接触到一些其他这些申请庇护的理由是些什么？
在我采访当中印象比较深的是新疆维吾尔人这部分。那么在纽约的维吾尔人权活跃人士伊里夏提说，外界比较关注这些年发生的事情，也就是建立再教育营等等。其实他认为呢，新疆的逃亡潮从胡锦涛执政时期后期就开始了，到了习近平时代呢就更加严重了。我们来听听伊里夏提是怎么描述维吾尔人逃亡的第一波是怎么开始的。
2012、2013、2014年开始急剧出现的是什么呢？一大批年轻人，年龄最小的可以达到十来岁，然后大的呢就是到20来岁的。第一批到了美国的这些维吾尔人呢，很多，因为我当时在那个移民局当翻译，给这些申请避难的，那么很多维吾尔人那个小孩子就告诉我，他们父母在他们临走之前告诉他们，到美国申请政治避难，再不要回来。这就是第一批出现的，我所亲眼见到的在美国的维吾尔。
此外呢，我采访到一些专门这个办庇护的华人律师，他们说呢，习近平反腐运动当中利用国际刑警组织发布红色通缉令，像这个猎狐行动等，也使得一些被追捕的对象在海外寻求庇护。另外，在纽约法拉盛专为华人办理庇护的这个凯森律师事务所的合伙人刘芳告诉我说呢，尽管中国政府从2016年已经改变了一胎化的政策，可以生两胎，现在更鼓励生三胎，但是以遭受一胎化迫害为由申请庇护，仍占着他们律师楼里面多数的案例。他谈到了给他印象最深刻的一个案例，就是有的客户告诉他说，他怀的孩子大概已经有9个月了，过2个星期就可以生了，结果被计生办的人抓到医院，医生摸着孩子的头，往这个孕妇的肚子里打了一针，最后呢，生出了一个死胎。文浩。
非常残忍的经历呢，也感谢记者方斌的你的详细介绍和报道。
美国之音美国观察的留言信箱，欢迎您对节目中的新闻事件和热点话题发表看法，请耐心等待提示音后留言。
今年81岁的亚洲协会美中关系中心主任夏伟研究中国的问题已经超过了60年。他曾经陪同3位美国总统访问中国，并且在1979年全程报道了邓小平访美。曾任伯克利新闻学院院长的他，在80岁的时候多了一个新的头衔——小说作家。他花费30年的时间撰写了《故乡》这本书，将毕生对中国的观察融入在这本以鲁迅作品题名的书当中。主角小李经历了文革、改革开放、美国梦，最后故事结束于89天安门屠杀。夏伟最近接受美国之音的专访，谈论他对于这本书以及当前美中关系的看法。他认为习近平的领导之下，美中重回最初的彻底撕裂是他从来没有想到过的。
Professor Shou, you talk about the change from a nonfiction writer to novel writing, and it was like gender reassignment. Could you tell us like the major adjustment that you need to make in the process?
Well, that's a question that really lies at the heart of the difference between novel and reportage of a factual nature. I spent my whole life writing books that were historical and factual.And it's a strange and I think somewhat frightening liberation to be freed of the facts. In other words, to create characters and narrative that say what you want to say, even when an actual person won't say that for you. So it was precisely that freedom that I think made me want to try to write fiction, because the more time I spent in China, the more I felt that there were issues that sort of divided the U.S. and China and separated people in ways that it was very difficult to get to in journalism or history. And what I mean to say by that is there are things that can be said maybe through literature or through people's appreciation of music or their engagement with religion, psychology, that really, finally, I think, say as much about why the U.S. and China cannot get along and why China does what it does. It isn't that we haven't found the perfect policy. It's that there's some very complicated and sometimes contradictory forces at work, which almost defy anybody's easy analysis. So that's what sent me off on a 30-year odyssey into writing historical fiction.
Many parts of your novel are based on solid research, obviously, including life in Qinghai, in Beijing's Alley areas, Hutong, Central Music Academy, and San Francisco, also like the restaurants and the laundromat. It may take many years accumulation, right?
A lot of the research that one does is just to live it. And I mean, I spent a lot of time in China, and my wife was Chinese. My children speak Chinese. My wife's parents still live in Beijing. So, I mean, we had friends that lived in the Hutongs, and I spent some time living there myself and just feeling that very sort of beehive-like attitude that these narrow little alleyways clustered with courtyard houses and little shops at the ends that created. And it was very unique. I think it's all gone now, or almost all gone. And then, of course, in 1981, just as China was opening up with the, reform and opening period of Deng Xiaoping, I noted that the Chinese Mountaineering Association was allowing mountain climbers to go and climb some peaks that had been closed for decades. So I thought, well, this looks interesting. So I got on one mountain climbing and trekking trip, and we ended up spending, over a month in Qinghai. And that's where I ran into the Goluks, the Guola Zhiqu. And so I thought, well, let's run my character up there. That's a kind of really interesting, strange, out-of-the-way place. And it also just happens Qinghai is the headquarters for the reform through labor, re-education through labor camps, and all sorts of pieces of the Chinese gulag, the penal colony. So, I took those elements of experience that I had had in some measure and tried to weave it into the fabric of a good story.
There are quite a few Chinese characters, 中文翻译, in your novel. So for Chinese language users, it's not hard to understand, but like for American readers who are not so familiar with Chinese, what could they respond to that?
If you're trying to figure out the U.S. and China riddle, how the U.S. and China can and cannot relate to each other, one of the big challenges is the language. So I thought to try to merge these things together in some regard, at least would be a symbolic attempt to bring, the yin and yang together, the East and West, all of these contradictions. I mean, Chairman Mao loved contradictions. He wrote many, many quite interesting essays on contradictions. He saw the world as a contradiction, and indeed, the U.S. and China are a contradiction. And it's exactly the nature of that contradiction that I wanted to try to better understand since I spent my whole life living it. And, when I first went to China, initially I had to go to Taiwan to study Chinese because Americans couldn't go to China. And then I went in 1975 at last and spent several months working in a agricultural model brigade, the Dajai, Dadui, the agricultural brigade in Shaanxi province, and then in the Shanghai electrical machinery factory. And the thing that's just really completely bewildered me was you could not make friends with anybody. Now, why was that? I spoke Chinese. I thought I understood Chinese. I'd spent a lot of time with Chinese in Hong Kong, Taiwan, and America. And yet it was like oil and water, separate. Well, there were reasons, and that was So what were the reasons? The reasons were that the U.S. and China had very different narratives about each other. And Mao saw the U.S. and China as what he called an antagonistic contradiction. And it was not one that could be just solved by talking and peacefully. He saw it as one that probably had to be resolved by struggle and violence. And we're still there, this term, you know, hostile foreign forces that the Chinese Communist Party uses to speak of that contradiction.
Lu Xun certainly plays an important role to you when approaching the big topic of China study. What are the reasons? It seems like his works are not as important as before in China. Many of his work have been out of textbook in China. What do you think about the possible reasons behind this move?
Well, Lu Xun was not a Paimapi, not a panderer to the Chinese Communist Party. He was a leftist, but he did not like what he saw of sort of Leninist party structure. And he really was one of the last writers who had a deep independence, a streak of independence. And he was someone who recognized that he was caught in between all kinds of things. He was caught in between left and right, between Confucian culture and modern culture of the West, between East and West, science and all sorts of superstition. He was a wonderfully ironic, funny, witty, biting person who just didn't fit in. But Mao Zedong happened to like him. So he acquired a status, and he continued, where in actuality, I think his writing, from any Maoist perspective, deserved to be censored. So now he has been forgotten, just because he reminds people like Xi Jinping and the Chinese Communist Party that what an independent voice actually sounds like. And so I called my novel, My Old Home, Guxiang. The wonderful, wonderful Lu Xun's short story about returning home and years later as a successful writer and running into his peasant boyfriend as a boy and realizing the great class difference and the great gap that was between, a very sad and beautiful story. So I felt that was a bit like what I wanted to speak of in the novel, was that in a certain sense, many Chinese are in exile. You know, they left in 1949. Many are leaving Hong Kong now. I mean, there's a huge theme of being in exile, of not being able to be comfortable on either side. You can't be there and you can't be here. And that, to me, is part of the great tragedy of China, is that it makes people choose. At the same time that the world is globalizing and people are becoming accustomed to living in several cultures or two cultures at once, we now find ourselves decoupling again.
The novel covers the time period from 1949 to 1989, quite depressing time for Chinese people, actually, especially like the Li family and his friends. They are intellectuals. They are called Chou Lao Jiu that time. And if your readers feel a little bit low when reading it, what could you say to them to make the reading experience very worthy?
Well, I guess I would say that in a certain sense, Chinese history does have a lot of tragedy in it. And that's one reason the Chinese Communist Party keeps trying to change history, rewrite history to make it look better than it was. I mean, the party caused immense suffering. It did some good things too, but it caused just, you know, 30, 40 million people died in the Great Leap Forward, and then there was a Cultural Revolution. So what I have to say is that's the way it is. And it is sort of the tragedy of China that as it came to finally find its balance and undergo this period of remarkable economic growth, it went through an awful lot of self-inflicted agony and pain and damage. And you can't deny it. And the only thing I could do in writing fiction was to try to put a little bit of humor into it, because actually I think, you know, the Chinese have a wonderful sense of humor. It's one that they've developed as a survival mechanism, and it can't always be said in public, but there is a tremendously wry way of looking at the absurdity of much of what happened in the Chinese Communist Revolution and the pomposity and the sort of grandiose, overweening, you know, arrogance of the way leadership and leaders unrestrained sometimes act. So I tried to have create some characters sort of like you know, up in Qinghai, little autocrats who live who rule their tiny, insignificant world just the way Mao Zedong and Xi Jinping rule the country.
In their relationship, Little Li as a rebel under Mao, he seeks stability and constancy. And for Juliet, the child of a capitalist society ends with embracing the idea of great disorder under heaven. How do you get this kind of inspiration for the relationship part between Little Li and his American girlfriend?
I think America for him, as for many Chinese, particularly in the 1980s, was this land of a different kind of liberation, of sort of freedom and spontaneity and individualism and you know, excess too. So he goes to America and he ends up with this American dancer whose whole sort of idea is to sort of overthrow the establishment, whereas Little Li is trying to find order and steadiness. Just having come out of the Cultural Revolution, she's sort of looking for individual fulfillment and a little bit reckless. So there's a clash there between his idealization of America, you know, that expression in Chinese, you know, 中国的月亮比中国的月亮圆, the moon in America is rounder than in China. I think a lot of Chinese, particularly in the 80s, had that idea. But when they came to America, of course, they realized America was a reality of its own. It was ambiguous, too. It had pluses and minuses and strengths and weaknesses. And it was a very, I think, sometimes a difficult experience. And yet to go home was a difficult experience. So then where do they go? Which side do they belong on? It's not clear.
Reviewing your research on China over the past 60 years, what do you think about the current U.S.-China relation?
I think it's surprising to me that having spent my whole life, you know, I started studying China in the 1950s when I was at Harvard, when you couldn't go there. And I didn't get to China for 20 years. I could go around the outside, enviously looking in. I used to be very envious of my Canadian friends who could go to China, but I couldn't. And I remember lying on the beach in Taipei, sort of between Taipei and Jilong, and listening to radio broadcasts. You know, that was illegal, but we did it anyway, and transistor radios coming in from China during the Cultural Revolution and dreaming of going there. And then finally, I did go there. And finally, things did come together. And the 1980s was an amazing period of openness and hope and close interaction. And then we all know what happened in 89, but then things came back again under Jiang Zemin. But under Xi Jinping, we are completely tearing the fabric apart again. And I never thought I'd see that day, that we'd return to exactly the place where I began, you couldn't go there. Friends were disconnected, businesses had trouble, universities had to kind of disconnect. And all of the sort of interactions that we laboriously built up with foundations and NGOs and people to people and musical groups and you name it, they're all pulling apart now. And I don't think anyone has any idea how to stop it. And that to me, is a kind of a bitter end, just as the end in my own book is quite bitter. The hero dies.
Y上就是美国观察的全部内容，感谢收看，我们下次再见。